I'm Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro, and there's a lot to talk about. You know, one of the things we've seen recently is a great American pastime. And of course, I talk about the Super Bowl. Well, the problem with the Super Bowl is I haven't been watching for the past couple of years. And I think the reality is a lot of people haven't been watching because of the kneeling. With the constant kneeling all the time, it's very difficult to have our military, our law enforcement, and our traditions disrespected. Now, that being said, I understand they're trying to make a statement. We've talked about that. I've written articles about it here for America Out Loud, is that when you don't feel you're being heard, you have to do something to be heard. Now, I'm not talking about the merits of the argument. I'm talking about why people would do that. Why would they kneel when they know it hurts so many people? It certainly doesn't bring us together. Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing, trying to find a way to get together now? We have President Biden, and we have his administration, and they're going to save our country. We're going to have great job situations. All the people from Keystone are going to be building solar panels and doilies and doing all kinds of other stuff for the same money, of course. I mean, you can't really expect them to give up a really good job and be happy with something that's, you know, less. So, of course, they'll have great benefits. They'll have great income from whatever it is that they're going to do next, whether that's making solar panels or doilies or whatever it is President Biden and his team are going to put together to help all of those people be employed. Now, what we find interesting here is this coming together with the Super Bowl is I had to watch a little bit of it. And I know that kind of sounds funky, but my father-in-law, Ted, likes football. He hasn't been watching it either, but as the weather gets cold, we try and find things to do to keep everybody engaged, something to talk about other than politics constantly. We watched some of the playoffs, and we were going to watch the Super Bowl because it helps keep people engaged, all right? Well, I have to say, just like there's Trump derangement syndrome out there, people for whatever reason just hate Trump no matter what the guy does, and you can't talk sense to anybody. I mean, you can understand some of the things the president does are a little off the wall. His commentary sometimes can be abrasive, but the things that he did good for the country, I don't know how you argue with that and say I'd rather not have good things for the country because I don't like the way this man speaks. That's a whole nother conversation. The other kind of derangement syndrome is the Brady derangement syndrome. People who, just for whatever reason, absolutely hate, the quarterback, Brady. You know, why do they hate this guy so much? Well, it became a conversation in the past couple of months where people started. It was a possibility. Could he get to the Super Bowl? He was past his prime. He's not past his prime. He's the GOAT, you know, the greatest of all time. No, he's not. And I got a little insight here. We are Giants fans when we were football fans here. We like the Giants. They don't win all the time, but when they do, it's very exciting. So we like the Giants because they're our New Jersey, New York team, right? And Brady was our archenemy because he was with the New England Patriots, and we played a couple of Super Bowls against New England. The Giants won, you know, just to say, twice against Mr. Brady. But the reality is that people are out of their minds with hatred for this guy. And you try and figure out why is it. Well, first of all, he's a good looking guy. I mean, you know, he's a good looking fella. You got to admit that. So that really bothers a lot of people. Number two, he's great at what he does. That bothers people. That really, sometimes people just hate when somebody's really good at something. They like them on the way up, but once they get there, you know, what I'm hearing a lot of people say, enough already. How many times can he win? Then he's got a gorgeous supermodel wife, okay? So there's some jealousy, I think, there. And I think the last straw is the guy's got millions and millions and millions of dollars. So it from the outside, it looks like this guy has the perfect life. Good looking fella, gorgeous wife, tons of money, and he's excellent superstar player. But he's been too good for too long. And this is the kind of things that I hear from people. So I tell you that Brady wasn't our favorite around here because he was always the arch enemy of the Giants. And he was so good. You always knew that the Giants could be up by 25 points with 2 minutes left to go. And Brady would find a way to pull that game out and win by 1 point or 10 points. It just, he's that good. But what I have adopted, even when I wasn't watching every week, what I started to see was that we can appreciate greatness in an individual, skill in an individual, ability in an individual that you may not see in other places. Now, there's no doubt that that Brady is probably the greatest quarterback that ever played the game. He's calm under pressure. He is smart running the game, deadly accurate with his passes. And the thing that I found that I like about him, that I could switch my feelings about the guy, was that we are witnessing greatness that we may not see for generations to come. I mean, there's only so many Hank Aarons, you know, and when Hank Aaron is off the field, it's a while till we find someone who can be as good of a hitter as him. Prior to him, there was Babe Ruth, and there was many, many, many years, generations between Babe Ruth's excellence and Hank Aaron's excellence. And then we had generations between Hank Aaron and the fellas that were hitting home runs, you know, with the asterisk next to it because they were all using juice. They were juicing, so we're told, to hit all those home runs. And that's what I'm seeing with Brady, though. And that's what I'm appreciating, even if I'm not appreciating the league anymore. I appreciate someone who has risen to the top, and he is the best. He has set the standard now for what the best looks like, for how the best performs. And you have to appreciate that. I mean, I remember when I was younger, when it comes to President Trump, when he was just Donald Trump, and people liked him. He was funny. He was a man about town. He was, you know, this rich guy running around doing all kinds of stuff. And then all of a sudden, he had the TV shows and he was real popular. But I always liked Donald Trump because I said, here's a guy who is an absolute multimillionaire, and I hope one day to kind of learn from this and maybe be that successful. Well, that's the kind of thing I think we here in America, we have this whole weird, when people are really successful, we have a tendency to turn against them. You know, it's like, okay, you were good, but that's enough. And that's what I'm hearing people say. Enough already with this Brady. How many can he win? He can win as many as he can. Other people need to be as good or better than him if they want to win. Now, that doesn't make for an exciting league. I understand that. You know, he's, you know, like, I remember in the, I guess, the late 70s, the early 80s, the Yankees in baseball, they won the World Series like every other year. They were in it constantly. And they, even if they were down by, you know, 20 games, 30 games going into the playoffs, they ended up winning the playoffs, getting there, winning, and then winning the World Series. And Bob Grant, who was a real favorite of mine, talk radio guy back in the day, Bob Grant used to call them the New York Inevitables because it was inevitable that they would be in the playoffs and in the World Series. That's how many times they were there. Well, it didn't make for exciting baseball if you were from the rest of the country. But if you were from the New York, New Jersey area, it was very exciting because your team won constantly. You know, that was pretty exciting. And that's the kind of thing I think we see with Brady. Now, the Buccaneers are not my local team, but to see someone perform at that level, to be that good, is something that should inspire lots of people. It should inspire young kids who want to play ball and who want to be the best. And I think because there's such hatred, we don't really hear Brady's whole story. I remember when he was picked like 126th out of the draft. He was not picked because he was a superstar. He was picked just in the course of things. He was a college ball player, and people needed a quarterback, and New England took him, and he was on the bench behind Drew Bledsoe. And Drew Bledsoe was a good quarterback, and New England was having some success, and then Bledsoe got hurt. And out of nowhere, here comes Brady. You know, they pull him off the bench, and he goes out there, and within a couple of years, this guy has become the ultimate quarterback, which is what I coined a while ago, the American Idol effect. You know, how many of us out here in the world, anywhere, in any group of people, could really be extraordinary in many different fields if we were given the chance, right? So I call it the American Idol effect because you take somebody like Carrie Underwood, who is now one of the biggest stars in music, and you realize that if it wasn't for that show, if it wasn't for her getting that opportunity to go up on that stage and sing, she would still be waiting tables in Kansas somewhere because she just didn't have the money or the backing to get in front of huge audiences. But she had an opportunity to shine, and she had great talent. And she went out there, and she set the stage. Now she, like I said, she's one of the biggest stars in all of music because she was given a chance. So I find the whole Brady derangement syndrome thing to be misplaced because people are looking at it differently than I'm looking at it, okay? I'm trying to look at it in, you know, why can I appreciate a guy that for years I didn't appreciate and didn't want to have anything to do with because he could beat my team? Because he is excellence. He is absolute excellence. And we should aspire to excellence. That's the only thing that drags our entire society forward. If we all aspire to excellence, no matter what it is we do. If you're a garbage man, be the most excellent garbage man that there's ever been. If you're a doctor, be the most excellent doctor. If you're a teacher, be the most excellent teacher you can be. And that's how all of us benefit, right? From these God-given talents. We may not have them, right? I may not be a Brady or a Carrie Underwood to do the things that they can do. But I can appreciate the brilliance that they bring to the thing that they do. And that's what I ask everybody out there in Chasing Justice Land. What is it that you do? You know, have you really pursued the things that you can do, the skills you have? You know, not all of us can do that. Not all of us have the time or the money to be able to pursue things other than our job. You know, that's a reality. We have to work to live, to feed our families, do that. But we all have these God-given talents that we may not ever realize. So my suggestion to everybody is instead of hating Brady, all right, for being such a winner, learn from him. Watch what he does. And that's why I always hope that his story was told a little more instead of just that he's this super excellent ball player, hero, great guy. Let's talk about the story of him being picked 126th, being a benched quarterback, a backup who was probably not going to see the light of day for a long time because Bledsoe, if he didn't get hurt, probably would have had some great success. He was a good player too. So it doesn't matter the sport. It doesn't matter the venue in which you can rise to greatness. The key is to rise to greatness as best as we can. That, I think, is a good use of our God-given talents. God has given us these talents, whatever they are. If it's making bread, make the most awesome bread. Right? It doesn't matter what your skill or your talent is. And if you don't know what your skill or talent is, try some new things. It enhances yourself, it enhances your world, and it can enhance, you never know, it can enhance everything around you. You know, how many people could be great singers if they were given the chance? How many of these young kids that we see today in places that we call impoverished, in our hard-hit economic neighborhoods, regardless of anybody's race, but how many of these young kids out there could be the next greatest anything if they had opportunity, right? How many of them could solve the problem of cancer? How many people could solve the next great mathematical question that'll unlock real renewable fuel, right? I think they're out there. We just may never hear from them. And that is a tragedy. And that is the beauty, I think, of America, is that a lot of the things that we have when it comes to being inventors and singers and sports players and great legal minds and all of that comes to us because we have the freedom to explore it. We have to make sure we don't lose that freedom to explore, because the next great thing can come from anywhere. It can come from you, your children, your grandchildren, somebody who's given an opportunity that they might not have had. And this is where I see a place for government. You know, I think education, so no matter how many trillions of dollars we spend on different things, let's spend it to do something good for these people that need it in our country. Because you know what? We need them to be great. I think that's really the point of my thought here, is that I thought about that, just looking at that American Idol example. The next great doctor that's going to create a cure, maybe somebody we never, ever know about because they come from an impoverished area, or they don't have an opportunity to go to school, or they have problems. Now, this is not a bleeding heart approach. This is a realistic, I think, practical understanding that we have so much talent in this country that we have to keep our freedom. You know, right now we're all afraid that we're losing our freedoms. We feel like we're losing a lot of our freedoms. We feel like, you know, with the change in government, a different philosophy, they're going to be much more restrictive, and that's going to limit us. I think it might. I think that's a reality. But do you see the value of freedom in this collective mind we have as Americans? Can really change the future. So that's, I just want to cover that today. Now listen, the rest of our show today, I'm going to have a good friend of mine on, Captain Donna Roman Hernandez. Donna is a retired police captain from New Jersey. She is a pioneer of women in law enforcement. She was one of the first women supervisors who rose through the ranks. Very accomplished person. She is now an expert trainer and teacher on many different topics, including those related to domestic violence, as well as human trafficking, and the investigation of these two amazingly important topics to all of us. So I've asked Donna to come on and talk with us a little bit. So segments 2 and 3, she's going to come on and discuss these specialties that she has, and she is shining. So it kind of fits my theme, right? What I want to tell you also is that Donna is a filmmaker. In addition to being a trainer and a retired police officer, she's a filmmaker. And we've had her on here before to talk about some of her films. She's blueforcefilms.com. Blueforcefilms.com. Go look it up. You can see about Donna. You can see some of her clips, her trailers. She's an award-winning documentarian. She did a documentary on Sergeant Ken Hogan from New Jersey here. Ken was shot multiple times by a suspicious person he was sent to investigate, and the individual walked up to his police car, pulled a gun out of nowhere, and started blasting away. And Ken was hit multiple times, and he managed to survive, call for help, and save himself. So it's called Cop Shot, The Aftermath. It's an amazing movie you can watch. She also has many, many other documentaries that she has done on law enforcement and life in general. So Captain Donna Roman Hernandez, she'll be back with us in a minute here on Chasing Justice. In the meantime, this is Lieutenant Joe saying, remember, hey, stand by. We'll be right back.
Well, my fellow Americans, how did you feel watching footage on the news of domestic terrorists looting our stores and burning our cities down? You were probably disgusted and angry as much as I was. It's disturbing what's going on. Well, you'd be shocked to know that your shopping habits are supporting these extremists. Companies like Amazon, Nike, Disney, FedEx, it's an endless list. And they've been supporting these radical groups. Let's stop supporting companies that fund these extremist groups. We can all do our part. Visit shoptotheright.com and you'll find businesses in a nationwide database and companies that are aligned with our American values. Visit shoptotheright.com and let's all make a difference.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro, and I have a very special guest with me this afternoon. Want to introduce everybody to somebody who's been on our show once before. She's retired out of Caldwell, New Jersey, and I'm going to let Donna tell you a little bit about herself. She is an amazing woman with an amazing career, and she started a second career that you're going to want to know about. So
Donna, thanks for being on today.
Joe, thanks again for inviting me to be on the show. It's always a pleasure. And hello, everyone on Joe Pangaro's show audience. It's wonderful to be here, especially during a pandemic when everyone is dealing with such a crisis. Unfortunately, I know how to handle crisis situations. And a lot of my trainings that I do for law enforcement and civilians are about trauma-informed response in crisis. And some of the classes that I teach are domestic violence, human trafficking, sexual assault, and trauma-related responses to critical incidents, wounded officers, and things of that nature.
That's great. So just give us a little bit about your background, Donna. What is your training expertise, and how long were you an officer? Tell us a little bit about your career.
I started my career at the Essex County Police in Newark, New Jersey, which is Essex County. I transitioned to the Caldwell Police Department after a layoff. I served a total 30 years in law enforcement, and much of that time I was in a supervisory position, command position. I retired at the rank of captain, and I oversaw the patrol unit, the domestic violence response unit, central communications, and I also was the accreditation manager for the borough of Caldwell.
Is that all? That's all you did?
it seems like a lot, but as you know, Joe, you have similar experience handling all types of command and patrol responsibilities, investigations, especially on your behalf. On my behalf, I did a number of investigations, very diverse investigations. I also was an adjunct faculty trainer with the Office of the Attorney General, a division of criminal justice in New Jersey. I was one of their lead trainers, where we trained officers, supervisors, and investigators, including prosecutors, office investigators, how to respond to and handle incidents of domestic violence and prepare to go forward with prosecutions for such cases. I did that as an adjunct faculty member for about 15 years.
And you're designated as a master trainer, is that correct?
Yes, I'm a master trainer, in part because of the amount of knowledge and certifications that I have received through the appropriate vetting process and certification process. But also I'm a survivor, and I've lived the experiences of being a survivor of sexual assault and survived over 20 years of domestic violence in my own family at the hands of my father. So I lived it, I've written about it, and I've learned about it. So it's that combination that puts me in the master class category. Basically, there's not too much I can be fooled about, so to speak, as an expert, because I know the truth, because, you know, it impacted me personally, psychologically, physically, and I had to learn more about the trauma to get through the trauma through some trainings and also some one-on-one type trainings with experts in the field.
Your experiences there are amazing. And that's one of the reasons I wanted you to come on. Let me try and tie all this together and let everybody know. So under full disclosure, Donna and I have known each other for years and years. And recently, Donna has agreed to provide some of her training to my company, True Security Design Pangaro Training. So Donna's going to be presenting several of her programs through my company. I just want to make sure that we put that out there to everybody. But one of the things that we're talking about a lot now is the pandemic, and not just the virus that's going to hurt you, do whatever, but people are suffering in other ways that are really not involved with the virus. There's domestic violence going on at home. Our kids are suffering mentally because they're not in school. I think there's a huge amount of PTSD that we're going to experience as a society once this starts to come off because of this lockdown. If you could talk to the domestic violence, and what do you think, I'm right about that? Is that something that would concern you? And what can somebody at home who's suffering DV because it is now, what can they do? How do they start to save themselves?
You're spot on, Joe, and you're very intuitive. Domestic violence and any type of victimization, whether it's sexual assault, child maltreatment, elder abuse, that somehow collectively fit at different points in time under a domestic violence statute, accelerate because people during a pandemic are in crisis. Our world is in crisis. Our world is hot. So that means our households and our workplaces are hot too. People not only show who they really are in crisis, but they have a tendency to overreact and some underreact. People try to minimize what they're going through. You have a lot of alcoholism, drug abuse that festers. People have a lot of time on their hands and they may not have money. So with that comes worry about what's going to happen tomorrow. Crisis is identified through a therapeutic process, identified what you need, what your needs are. But when people aren't able to go to a hospital so freely as they would have normally been if they have a problem, a medical problem, or see a psychologist or a therapist for an addiction problem, it remains inside the individual. So the individual who's suffering like that, or a household that suffers with it, it escalates. And it takes many different, it can turn to very dark forms, or it can turn to very inward forms where people have a boilerplate inside of them and then they can just react and may not be the type of person that reacts with violence. It could be verbal violence. It could be manipulative, coercion and control. There's so many things that are happening that not even the household can identify what's going on. Everyone just says, well, everybody's going through something and it's hard times.
And how can that express that self? I mean, what kind of things happen when you have, you know, verbal altercations as opposed to where you all think of somebody getting hit or punched? We kind of get that. How does this express itself, this hotness in our homes and in our lives here?
Well, it can manifest in several different ways. If a behavior of someone who is nonviolent or non-confrontational becomes that, that's a red flag. If daddy has never, or mommy has never pushed a child or screamed at a child in the household, that's a red flag. If grandma and grandpa are within the nucleus of the household and their needs are being dismissed, or they're not being taken care of as well, or a caretaker is not able to come into the home and the home has to take now become the caregivers and caretakers for others, that creates tension. They may not have the ability to do that. They may not want to do that. So it's a group of people who normally go to work, go to school, have someone to come in and take care of household chores or people, now are stuck. I have to admit this, full disclosure. I have PTSD. And throughout this pandemic, I have been triggered in ways that I was never triggered before. Repressed memories have come to the forefront. The feeling of not being able to leave my house with freedom. The feeling of something evil is out there. We can catch it. We can die from it. All of these things, although did not cause fear for me before, my triggers of trauma are not relegated solely to the umbrella of sexual assault and sexual violence.
Right. So these things have a tendency to bleed over then, so to speak, in other parts of your life, not directly connected to your particular trauma, but into any trauma.
Any trauma. And you never know where it's coming from. It could come from left field. Something, I could hear something and relate to it. And then that relatability brings me back to a memory that I've repressed.
Right.
Or a fear that I've had, because crisis is about fear of the unknown, fear of what's happening, fear of what could happen. It's a sequence of events and moments that cause one to feel unsure, unsteady, stuck, depressed, repressed. I mean, I could put a whole number of other adjectives in there, but the feeling of not having control over the moment, that moment in time that builds up, and we act out. We're human beings.
Right, and that's where the violence can come, is what you're saying. At that moment when they act out, it can be either a verbal beating you give someone or a physical beating that you might not have done before because of the trauma.
Exactly, but if someone is not prone to being violent, it usually can start off with words. Or warning words. Don't make me do something I don't want to do. I'm not feeling great today. I'm so angry. I could punch a wall. You know, and sometimes it's seen in the pets in the house. It might start out that way because pets are unconditionally lovers of humans, dogs and cats. And a person who's not prone to violence against people might start out with the violence against the pets or violence on property.
Sure. So that would be something that people might want to look for. If all of a sudden you notice someone who's not someone who strikes out, and now they get very upset with the dog just doing the normal dog things, you'd say, hey, that's out of character for this person. That could be a sign that they're under stress and they might need to get some help. Don, I think it's what would be helpful here is that you were on the show once before talking about a book that you've written that's going to be coming out soon.
Yes.
And you've made mention here a couple of times that you're a survivor of domestic violence. Could you just give us a couple of minutes for the audience so they understand where you're coming from, where all this understanding and expertise has come from?
Sure. My father was a police officer, and he was a young victim of domestic violence in his household by his mother. He joined the service, World War II. He escaped with his life, and he developed PTSD. And this was when a time when soldiers weren't diagnosed or didn't talk about it. He married my mom after he came back stateside. And she knew the first year into their marriage that she had made a mistake. Because she realized after speaking with his family members that many of the family members, especially the brothers, had what we would call, you know, domestic violence syndrome.
Mm-hmm. And what is that? What is domestic violence syndrome?
Well, it's someone who has either witnessed, been a bystander witness, or has personally experienced the violence in a household. Okay. Degrading, verbal, emotional, financial, and they carry that with them. And as one gets older, they incorporate that into their culture, their lifestyle, mm-hmm. and can act out. It's very diverse. They can act out in certain ways. They can take the role of the batterer. They can take the role of the person who was victimized. In my case, I watched my father, I witnessed my father perpetrate acts of domestic violence against my mother and acts of child maltreatment against myself and my two siblings. And as we got older, what he did fit under the statute of domestic violence because we were adults. He did that when we were minor children under the age of 18. But when we became adults, the violence increased because he knew we could tolerate more. Mm-hmm. My two siblings left. I was left with my mom, and he had his way because I feared anyone on the police department knowing what was going on. So I just tolerated the abuse. My mother became an alcoholic, and she used prescription drugs to get through the pain. And so it was a very uncomfortable household with the two of us. He had guns and I had guns. And
so at that point you had become a police officer when you became an adult. And you were suffering from this domestic violence abuse. And that's what you'd want to tell your brother and sister officers because you didn't want to get involved in that. But you were a cop at that point.
Yes. And my father tried to kill me twice. He tried to kill me once before I became a police officer. And he tried to kill me twice when he was very ill. And I went back to that house of horrors because my mother said I should just have some closure before he died. And he tried to kill me there at the house. And it was both times involving a firearm.
Right. Now, this entire story that you put together, your history, you've put that into a book, in the form of a book. Is that correct?
Yes. The book is called Battered Blue, and it will be released within the next couple of months. It was going to be released last year, but with the pandemic, I gave it a second look and some other additional thoughts I thought were important to talk about handling crisis. And so it will be published within the next couple of months. It's a memoir of sorts, but it's also an awareness piece from someone who lived it and someone who can help people get through it and get away from it.
Right.
So it's instructional in part.
And I think that's going to be very helpful for people. And I want my audience out here to know, like Donna said, the book is not out yet, but if you do reach out to me, I'm going to go on Twitter and let me know if you want more information, I will connect you with Donna.
AmericaOutLoud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all.
Your family may be suffering, or even
this
friends.
This is not a fight of Republican versus Democrat.
It's
not a fight of rich versus poor, old versus young, man versus woman, gay versus straight. It's not a fight of black lives, blue lives, Hispanic lives, or white lives.
You can reach out to me.
This is a battle of good versus evil. It's a fight for the soul of humanity. We are the vision of the voices, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Sometimes when I'm speaking about personal experience, I get lost in what happened to me. And you just put a thought in my head that I want to share. I never told anybody about this. The first time it came out publicly was when I did my documentary, The Ultimate Betrayal. And I had biological family members, not my siblings, turn against me and say, why did you come out with this story now? Why didn't you tell anyone? Well, because I knew no one would believe me, because my father had a Jekyll and Hyde personality. Family feared him. They knew there wasn't something right, but they never knew what went on. He swore us to secrecy. He said if we told anyone, he would kill us. And I knew he meant that, and he had the capability to do it. And I can remember, Joe, when I told you about it, how wonderful you were with me and how you embraced my victimization and you allowed me to tell you my point of view. And I knew you would believe me because you knew, I know you knew something was a little off with me over the years. And you gently held my truth in your hands and you didn't expose it to other people to make me feel shame or guilt. So I want to personally thank you for doing that. And thank you for all that you do, not only for victims, but helping police officers stay safe and alive. Because you can't trust somebody who's a domestic violence batter.
Donna, I appreciate your very, very kind words. But I remember when you told me the story, and as an officer, you go to tons of domestic violence calls, and they are probably the most disturbing and moving calls you can go on, because everyone can relate to a family. And I remember one of the first ones I went to, there was a mother and father, young couple, beating each other bad. And there was a little three-year-old girl there. And she clung to my leg and begged to come with me because mommy and daddy always fight. And I was moved emotionally by that, really shaken to my core, which gave me an understanding more and more about this. But Donna, I'm going to have to ask you to stay with us for a little bit longer, because we're just barely scratching the surface of what I want to talk to you about. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back in a minute with round three here on Chasing Justice with my guest, Donna Roman Hernandez, an outstanding law enforcement officer and an even better person. We'll be right back.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. This is not a fight of Republican versus Democrat. It's not a fight of rich versus poor, old versus young, man versus woman, gay versus straight. It's not a fight of black lives, blue lives, Hispanic lives, or white lives. This is a battle of good versus evil. It's a fight for the soul of humanity. We are the vision of the voices, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangara, and we're going to continue this conversation. You know what? Because we talked about the pandemic for months and months and months, and the lockdowns and the craziness that it can cause in our lives. Everybody is suffering at some point, one or another. I know some of the articles I have on the platform, AmericaOutloud.com, if you go back a couple of months into the articles that are there, I talked about my concern for kids going back to school. I think there's going to be more violence than there was before, if that's unbelievable to believe. But I think because these kids are so pent up, once we get back into school and we start functioning again, this PTSD is going to release itself. And my concern was not the kids that we are aware of, the ones who are on the radar, we're paying attention to them. I think there's going to be a lot of kids who are under the radar. We never might have seen them before. And this stress, this trauma of this lockdown is going to bring that out in them. And I think the same is even true, if not more so, for adults. So having Donna on here is, I think, is extremely important. And I appreciate, your story. And I think everyone's going to want to get a copy of that book. It's going to be helpful, Donna, more than maybe even you realize, because For you, it sounds to me like it's cathartic. It's you're getting your story out and you're cleansing it and you're facing it and you're not afraid of it anymore. But I think a lot of people that are going to read that story that maybe in your position that you were in years ago will see, hey, that's me. This isn't right. I can get out of here. This is not right, what's going on here, and maybe reach out for help. And I think that's the value that your book is going to have. And that's a tremendous thing to be able to do.
Absolutely. School for me was everything. My teachers applauded me, encouraged me, taught me, made me feel as if I had value every day. When I went to college, it was my time to shine, my time to learn, my time to make my own choices. It's very difficult for children to be at home, especially those who were like me or are like me, that needed to go somewhere else to get away from the violence, mm-hmm. to grow, where there was no trauma. Trauma kills.
Yeah, absolutely. That's stress. And you know what? You don't always see it. Sometimes, I think you had said this one time, the most painful assault on a person is not always the beating. Those things heal. It's the emotional scars that people may drag with them for the rest of their lives and affect every other part of their life.
You have it right, Joe. It's the expectation of the abuse. My father would posture in a way where he wouldn't have to do anything. He'd just give us a look. That look was comply. And trauma is spurred by, is visually spurred. It's physically spurred. Trauma is something that, unless you have a way to address the trauma, I went to years and years. I checked in and checked out of counseling. I kept that a secret too. Mm-hmm. And it was the counseling that helped me identify it.
Right. Give a description. It's got to be confusing to be going through it and not understand why you feel the way you feel. You know, you've said you were concerned about, you know, feeling guilty or not feeling guilty. From a person who hasn't gone through that, I say, why would you feel guilty? Somebody did that to you. But that's all part of being a victim of this and how it affects you.
It's the coercive control model, is that if you're told something long enough and manipulated and groomed in the right way, you start to believe it. They're lies that will never be truth. However, when you love someone, or you trust someone, or you're in the care of someone who is letting you know that they're doing things for you that no one else would do, you need them, you have to comply. If you'll get rewards if you comply. If you fight it, you're going to be punished. And so you believe that they are the link to your life story. Without them, you don't exist. Or in the case of my mom, she knew that she had nowhere to go, no resources during those times. Who do you tell? When she told family members, they said, that's the way it is. Culturally, they've all gone through that. Generationally, it's just something you deal with. You're married for life and that's part of it. Get over it. And so there's many facets to it. I'm just keeping it brief for the context of our conversation. It is very confusing. When I was writing the book, I was so confused at the new me and the old me. But then I realized there's a little girl in the middle of it all that still had those repressed feelings, that still wanted her day in court, that still wanted tough justice. So it's always that little inner voice that brings out the past. And it's hard to control that little voice, because that's the warning sign.
Donna, I hear what you're saying, and I think this is such a deep topic, and we know that they say there's a million incidences of domestic violence a year, and you and I both know that number is multiply times more than that, because most people don't report it. They don't go through it. They don't want the, you know, there's so many connections to the batterer, because if you call the police, they get locked up. That could be your financial way to feed yourself and your children. That can be the home that you live in. And then they get out eventually. And then they come back and they continue. So people don't report everything. And I know there's lots of people out there that really suffer from all of this. And I applaud you for doing this. Now, we can talk about this forever, but some of the training you're going to do for me, what's the name of the program you're going to be doing for True Security Design Pangaro Training?
Well, there are domestic violence investigations, sexual assault investigations, human trafficking is also included in there. The aftermath of a police-involved shooting. What happens to the cops after that? What happens to the departments after that? It's based on victimization and trauma. Trauma-informed response to children who are exposed to domestic violence is another course. I just want to make one mention, because I would be remiss if I didn't say this. Domestic violence is a learned behavior based on observations of violence that one has experienced either personally or witnessed. And it's all about power and control. Human trafficking, sexual assault, officer-involved shootings, domestic violence, trauma-informed response. People who perpetrate these acts, they are manipulative individuals, all about power and control, based on some learned behavior that they have seen or witnessed in their past that's not good, and how they act out with these toxic behaviors that really cause others to have suffer and have trauma. So victimization is a big piece of everything, but also investigating. How do you get the information you need to have a successful prosecution, to have somebody removed from that situation, the perpetrator, the batterer, and get them locked up to get help? We hope, doesn't necessarily mean that will happen, but so that victim, that survivor can leave. Sometimes they can only leave when you remove that person from the situation, mm-hmm. or provide some type of benefits or opportunities for the victim through advocacy.
Well, we all know, that people can be restrained, a piece of paper restraining order. And we see literally hundreds of times a year that the batterer, when they're finally held to account by the authorities, that piece of paper does nothing. They show up at the person's house and kill them because that's ultimate control over that person. You got the cops involved and now I'm going to do this. And we see these domestic violence homicides on a regular basis. This is not anything to take lightly in any way, shape, or form. And that's what the student officers are going to get from your program, those understandings that are different than just the in-service training where we talk about the law. You know, when you go there, you're required to do A, you're required to do B. If you see a mark, you must make an arrest. Your program is actually going to give them insight into the victim and into the batterer so they can do better investigations and maybe save those victims. Am I correct with that?
Spot on again, Joe. It's developing investigatory strategies to deal with specific types of grooming, victimization, and power and control situations.
Right. And it sounds to me like this is something that, you know, I do programs for schools also and teachers that, you know, we know that most reports of child abuse come from the teachers who notice something or see something or the kids say something. This is probably a program that we should extend to the schools as well for part of their in-service.
Yes, and part of the advocacy work that I do and volunteerism that I do is to high school students, colleges, talking about dating violence. And the root of problems begin in the household fester. You have child maltreatment. Children may be withheld food, mm-hmm. may be physically restrained. And having horrific things done to them for compliance.
Mm-hmm. And we've all seen that as we investigate. Now, it's interesting because there's a program, and I'm going to get the name wrong. You might know what the program is. It's starting out, of all places, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, is actually moving this this program. I'm going to be teaching a large school district in New Jersey, an urban school district. They have a lot of security officers, and I'm going to be teaching them de-escalation techniques. Well, one of the things they asked me to include in this was this, and I think it's the CARES program.
Yes.
Where we are trying to understand that, you know, a child that comes from some kind of a trauma, when something happens, say dad's arrested, mom's arrested, someone's stabbed, someone's shot, there's a search warrant executed at their home. That's traumatic for children, that the police will just send a form report to the school that tells them this child was involved in something at their home. And then the school is particularly trained to respond and keep an eye on that child, make sure how they're reacting, and to get them the help they need. And I think it's absolutely an amazing idea because
we don't always think of that end. You could catch that trauma there and maybe help it from festering into a lifelong wound.
You change the trajectory of how the child perceives life.
Yes.
When someone is unconditionally loves a biological caregiver, that those ties are hard to break.
Yeah.
And I knew at, I would say in my early teens, I started to have an awareness that something wasn't right because I saw the way my friends' fathers treated them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a comparison for me. And as I was becoming a young woman, he would say things to me that didn't make sense in my early teens, but resonated with me as I was getting older, that if I got pregnant, that he would cut the baby out of my stomach.
What a horrifying thing to say to anyone, let alone your daughter.
I have no children. I think that just was a permanent imprint in my mind as I grew up and was in different relationships, that I never saw myself as having children. Not that I didn't want to be a mom, but that what he said to me, I never forgot. Or he would say it when I had a boyfriend, I'll disfigure your face so that no boy would want to date you.
Such pain, Donna. I'm sorry that you went through that.
Yeah. Thank you. And those things remain with me today. I still have body issues that I deal with. I still don't feel adequate enough in some ways. And I overachieve. Mm-hmm. And you always say to me, you're always so busy.
I'm overachiever, no doubt about it.
Well, I'm overachieving. It's masked. Mm-hmm. I'm overachieving to mask pain.
Sure.
I'm overachieving to try to make up for all the lost time that I could not be the achiever in my father's eyes.
Well, I think Donna, just listening to your commentary, it's very clear you've gotten a handle on this for yourself and it's helping you. And that's why I'm so happy that you're going to be teaching and training with us, True Security Design Pangaro Training, because this is important. Now we only have a couple minutes left and I don't want to jump off this topic, because like I said, we could do 10 shows on this. It's that important. But the human trafficking program that you're also going to do, you know, I think when people hear that term human trafficking, you picture some clandestine, very rare thing that happens. We don't know anybody that's been human trafficked. What exactly is human trafficking? And is it only in one small area, or do you think it's all over? What is it we need to know about it?
It's global. And it's the modern day slavery, that you are promised something and it doesn't happen. And you become a slave, a sex slave. You're a worker slave. You work.
How does somebody's children, or how does a young woman get involved in human trafficking? I mean, a girl's from, she's from Sheboygan, Wisconsin. How does she end up as a sex slave? How does that happen?
There's a luring and a grooming process. She might be online. It's happening a lot online. She may meet someone online who is giving her compliments. Evidently, there's something deficient in the home life where she's seeking love, guidance, or attachment to someone else. It doesn't mean it could be same sex, different sex. It could be different ages and whatnot. But they're lured and groomed into believing that this person will take care of them, that they can give them a lot of love and affection and provide a better lifestyle for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it could be a long process of that, maybe online for a while, maybe by phone. And then there's a meetup. And that meetup usually is the snatch and grab, where that person is then taken and brought into a lifestyle that they have no clue is filled with things that are very bad and dark.
So and they when you say the snatch and grab, you know, we think of, you know, a little kid playing out in front of their house and the van pulls up and they grab them and drive away. You're talking about more of developing a relationship and then removing that person from their life. So do they do that in the same town, or do they take them away? I mean, why don't they just go home?
Trust. They have trust. It may not happen initially. It could be, you know, a couple of meets. It could be the one meet where the person has established a 6-month history. There's maybe an exchange of photos, and there's a promise. We're going to get married. I have a job for you. This is great. Whatever it is, it's modern day slavery.
Mm-hmm.
and they are not treated well. And those promises were false.
And how prevalent do you think this is?
No one can say, because everything is always done quietly. Until someone or ring is found out to be doing it, that person could be shipped to another country and trafficked that way.
That's the fear I think a lot of parents have, is that we're seeing like the FBI breaks up human trafficking ring and they find 43 children. What are they keeping them in the back of a truck? I mean, where are these kids?
Could be.
They're being kept.
Trailers, could be in basements, could be in big buildings, could be in those holding facilities at the seaports. A lot of this can come in through the seaports as well. Prostitution, sexual assault. It's a mess. It's a mess of the worst situations that lure, control, and enslave people who it's a false promise. That's the way it is. In some other nations, they go to schoolhouses in countries where a lot of, you know, they may be impoverished and they have one schoolhouse. Some years ago, they took a group of young women and enslaved them to one of these combatant forces in, I believe it was in Africa. One of the tribal leaders took them, and they became the sexual victims to the people who were out there fighting these wars of genocide.
Right. That was the Boko Haram. We saw that, where they took the whole school full of the girls, and
yes,
we never got them back, and people were trying to, you know, help them. Now, listen, I don't want to cut this short, Donna, because this is so important. I thank you so much for coming on here. And even more than that, I thank you for offering your services to True Security Design and Pangaro Training. You're going to help lots and lots of people. So thank you for being on. You'll hear more from Donna. We'll have her on again, because she does have so much to offer. Donna, thank you so much. And all of you out there in Chasing Justice Land, I hope you learned something here. There are signs and symptoms of domestic violence, human trafficking, all these things we can see. All right. So be careful out there. Keep your eye open on the people you love. Help who you can. Get help if you need the help. Reach out. Somebody's there. And remember, always be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. This is Lieutenant Joe Pangaro for True Security Design and Chasing Justice, signing off here on the America Out Loud Radio Network.